They would say no.
The Conference Committee for House File 2553 and Senate File 2824 will come to order. I think we'll start with very brief introductions. There probably isn't a lot of biographical detail noted, and since the Senate had to come down that long tunnel to get here, why don't we start at the end with Senator Betzold, and we'll just work around the horseshoe.
I'm Don Betzold. I've been in the Senate since 1993. I represent the area, including part of Fridley, Mound View, Spring Lake Park, and most of Blaine.
And I'm Senator Linda Scheid. I served 11 years in this body, the House, before I went to the Senate. I represent Brooklyn Center and Brooklyn Park. Deb Hilstrom and Mike Nelson are the two representatives in my district.
And I'm Nimo. I represent Senate District 67, which is the east side of St. Paul. My two House members are Representative Sheldon Johnson and Tim Mahoney.
I'm Kathleen Pontius. I'm counsel for the Judiciary Committee.
I'm Ron Latz. I represent St. Louis Park, Hopkins, and Golden Valley in the Senate. I'm in my first term. I served 4 years in the House. Two of those sitting next to Representative Simon on the floor. We both represent St. Louis Park area and the Hopkins. And Representative Winkler is my other House, actually my House member. So I'm pleased to be here.
Hi, Ryan Winkler, Senate District, or House District 44B. Obviously, rounding out the St. Louis Park Golden Valley contingent here today, and my first term in the legislature.
Mark Shepard from the House Research Department.
Christina Hughes, Legislative Assistant for Ryan Winkler and Committee Administrator for the Conference Committee.
Steve Simon, second term House member from Hopkins and St. Louis Park, and rounding out Senate District 44. Completely represented here.
Phyllis Kahn, Representative 59B. You're looking at my legislative district, part of my legislative district in this photo, and hope we'll get a good solution.
Representative Lauren Solberg, I've been in here to remember Linda Scheid, but she was in the House. We got a good House break. Representative District 3B, I live in Grand Rapids, and my senator is Senator Saxhog, and his district runs from the middle of Mille Lacs Lake up to and including the northwest angle. I got the lower half of that.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Chris DeLaForest. I represent District 49A in the House. That's the cities of Andover and Ham Lake in central Anoka County. I'm in my third term, and Debbie Johnson is my senator.
Luke Kuhl, DFL House Research.
Helen Robertson from the House Fiscal Staff.
And Matt Gehring from House Research.
Thank you. Just to give a kind of quick overview of the agenda, I'm going to just make a 1 or 2 minute opening comment. Senator Latz will do the same. Then we'll go into the side-by-side, the fiscal analyst presentation, and then we'll hear from survivors. I think we'll have some time for discussion after each one of the agenda items for questions, etc. It may make sense to try to hold questions until after we've gone through both the side-by-side and the fiscal presentation, but if there's anything burning that needs to be asked after Mr. Shepard and Ms. Pontius present, we can do that. In your folders, you have a letter from the governor, and I think in his letter he alludes to the two different concepts that really form the House and Senate bills. The House bill was conceived in the aftermath of two tragedies last summer, the 35W bridge collapse, as well as the southeastern Minnesota floods. We had a special session in September to address the southeastern Minnesota flooding, and despite the efforts of Representative Kahn, we were unable to get even process in place to begin to address the bridge collapse survivors. I think the unfortunate message to the bridge collapse survivors was that if a natural disaster disrupts your life and causes you significant personal disaster or tragedy, the state of Minnesota is there for you. If it's the state of Minnesota's bridge, however, you're going to have to be expected to take care of that on your own. I thought that message was intolerable and began developing with Representative Kahn and others a bill that aims to address that from the context of the similarities in many ways between the twin disasters of last summer. The bill in the House, from my point of view, aims to be fair It aims to be administratively simple, and it aims to be mindful of the state's legal and fiscal interests as well. The Senate bill developed somewhat differently. It developed through the claims subcommittee and developed through that process. And it also, I think, aims to acknowledge a unique state responsibility for the bridge collapse. And it also emphasizes the state's potential legal exposure and has that as, in part as a basis for fashioning this remedy. Senator Latz has led a very thorough and careful analysis of the legal issues facing the state, and I think should be commended for the very responsible approach he has taken to developing his proposal. I know that the Senate Judiciary Committee also has taken some considerable committee time to work through Senator Latz's bill, and I think you have performed a valuable public service in that regard as well. And I think despite the differences from which these two bills start, if you take a step back and look at it more broadly, they're actually quite similar, and I think share the same basic structure. Essentially, the legislature appropriates some fixed pool of money. The pool is administered or distributed by a third-party special master or a special master panel. Survivors, in order to claim any of the funds, must waive any claims they have against the state of Minnesota. And to the extent possible, both bills attempt to leave the existing state liability cap structure in place. And I think both recognize, in a sense, that this is a unique type of tragedy that is not contemplated in existing law. And I think both bills inherently have the two elements of a unique disaster response and a protection of the state's legal interests and fiscal interests. I think it's basically our job in the conference committee to sort through the two concepts that have come forward, find the best possible balance between the two, and understand that what we are doing may set a precedent for a future event, which we hope never occurs. And I guess the final point I would make is that both House and Senate have taken very strong votes in favor of both proposals, and I can't speak for the Senate, although I suspect it's true in both chambers, that many members weren't so involved in the details of how they were put together, but were taking a strong vote that the state has a special responsibility, and we're ready to task those of us in this conference committee to sort out the differences and come up with the best possible outcome for the state. And Senator Latz, I thought maybe you would want to offer a couple of opening comments as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members and those who are in the audience. I know we have a lot of survivors and family members are joining us today, too, and a lot of your faces have become familiar over the many hearings that I've had the opportunity to chair in connection with this event and to present that. I should recognize that among the Senate members here, we have Senator Moy chairs the Judiciary Committee, where this bill, the first standing committee of the bill, was heard in, and Senator Scheid chairs the Commerce Committee, where we went through a lot of the insurance-related issues as well. I co-chair the Joint House-Senate Subcommittee on Claims, which initiated proceedings early after the bridge collapsed. Many of those proceedings were informal and relatively behind the scenes in the early stages, and then we emerged with three lengthy hearings as full hearings of the committee and not just staff and others working on issues. This step was unprecedented in response to a state-related potential tort claim, a large disaster, if you will. The state has in the past, over many years, responded to acts of God, natural disasters, floods, snowstorms, tornadoes, whatever they happen to be. Fortunately, not often earthquakes in Minnesota. But we've never had an event like this, which is arguably directly related to human cause. Not an act of God, but human cause. People built the bridge, and somewhere along the line, people either failed or failed to act or took improper actions that resulted in the bridge collapsing. Now, which people, which organizations, that's still an open question, and we did not attempt to sort that out in the Subcommittee on Claims. But we have moved
expeditiously to try to address a new situation in the state of Minnesota. The ordinary litigation process would take 5 or 6 years and many appeals, and instead we're sitting here today, less than a year from this large event, looking at a compensation scheme. And I too will commend Representative Winkler for thinking creatively and out of the box in trying to address this. The Senate bill has tried to hew more narrowly to a specific response just to this incident and to retain the structure of existing government liability statutes in doing so. Mindful that whatever we do, whether we like it to be so or not, will be a significant precedent, policy precedent, and potentially legal precedent as well, which will be used by future claimants against the state as an example of how they think their cases ought to be handled. We have a lot to sort out. The Senate went through three standing committees. The third committee was the Finance Committee. All of the issues were thoroughly described. It came out of each committee without dissent. And there was an extensive floor debate in the Senate over an amendment offered to basically substitute the House language for the Senate bill. The two key components, there is a fair amount of overlap in the concepts, but there are two key differences between the House and the Senate bills. The first being the Senate bill applies the current statutory individual liability cap of $400,000. Actually, the $300,000 was in effect at the time of the bridge collapse. And secondly, the House bill has a $38+ million compensation fund, and the Senate portion of that is $25 million in compensation. So there was an amendment on the Senate floor to put in, to remove the individual liability caps and substitute the House numbers of $38 million. We had extensive debate, impassioned debate, heartfelt debate for over an hour on the Senate floor. A recorded vote was taken, and the amendment was defeated by a vote of 53-9. So the Senate has spoken on record quite clearly that it does not accept the House version, at least those key components of the House bill. So because of the differences between the two bills, we are here today, and hopefully we can find enough common ground to move forward.
Senator Lapp. I think we'll move now to Mr. Shepherd and Ms. Pontius to present. Rather than going through the revisers side-by-side, which I think would be less productive, they prepared basically a conceptual side-by-side, which lays out the varying concepts in the bill. And I don't know if Mr. Shepherd will begin or Ms. Pontius, but I'll turn it over to them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Ms. Pontius and I are going to be alternating back and forth to describe some of the House and Senate provisions. As Representative Winkler indicated, there are two documents in your packet. The first is a narrative side-by-side that's on 8.5x11 paper, and also the reviser side-by-side is in your packet. We thought it would be helpful to work off of the narrative conceptual side-by-side today, but at any point at which it would be helpful to look at the specific language, we can move to that. In general, as Representative Winkler noted in his opening remarks, the House bill is structured a little bit differently from the Senate in that the House creates a codified law to deal on a permanent basis with catastrophes that would be declared by the legislature. And so the House has a codified structure and then has a separate article that deals specifically with the I-35W catastrophe. For purposes of the side-by-side, what we've tried to do is to kind of combine some of the House language, so we moved some of the House language that deals with specifically with the I-35W catastrophe up to be next to the codified House language, so for purposes of this side-by-side, you can see it all together in one place. And Ms. Pontius, I think, could then talk about the state tort claim limits in the Senate bill.
Mr. Chair and members, the Senate bill, well, does two things. First of all, it retroactively increases the individual cap on state tort claims to $400,000 effective August 1st, which was, you know, the time of the bridge collapse. That that increase did take place on January 1st this year, so it just moved that increase back. At the same time, the bill itself also has a $400,000 cap on the amount of loss that's compensable for victims. I think both bills waived the $1 million cap per incident, so that the only limitation on the total amount paid out would be the availability of appropriations for that purpose.
And Mr. Chair and members, the House bill does not deal with the statutory state tort claim limits at all. The findings of the bills are relatively similar. The House has a codified statement of findings about why the House is enacting a general law that would apply to all catastrophes, and then it has a specific uncodified statement declaring the collapse of the I-35W bridge to be a catastrophe, stating that the state should compensate the survivors. The Senate has a bit more detail on the circumstances of the collapse and states that the compensation process furthers the public interest in avoiding litigation. Down at the bottom of the first page of the comparison, then, there's some differences in the way that the bills define loss and damages. The House bill defines loss in three separate subdivisions. It defines the total concept of loss as the sum of economic loss and non-economic loss. And it has a new definition that applies for purposes of this bill. Economic loss is some of the traditional items: loss of earnings, medical, loss of business or employment opportunity, and then it has non-economic loss for physical and emotional pain and suffering, physical impairment, mental anguish, disfigurement. The House, as the, both the House and the Senate bills say that damages don't include punitive damages or attorney fees or costs. And then Ms. Pontius could perhaps comment on the Senate damages provision definition.
Mr. Chairman, members, the Senate basically just allows damages that would be recoverable under tort law. Now, in fact, you know, if you look at the definition of loss under the House bill, a lot of those items that are listed would be compensable under tort law. The one area that I thought there might be a difference between what would be compensable or not under the two bills would probably involve victims who were on the bridge at the time, or survivors on the bridge at the time of the collapse, but who did not have any physical injury. The tort law does allow for a recovery in some cases where you don't have physical injuries. There's a tort called negligent infliction of emotional distress, so even though someone isn't actually physically injured, they're in the zone of danger, which I think clearly anybody who was on that bridge would be within that zone. They have to suffer severe emotional distress, and then they also have to have kind of attendant physical manifestations of that emotional distress. So, in looking at the definitions, I think the House might allow damages in cases where they didn't quite rise to the level of being a negligent infliction of emotional distress, but otherwise they're fairly similar.
Mr. Chair, members, I do agree exactly with what Ms. Pontius said about the differences in the House and the Senate on the damage issue. Turning to page 2 of the comparison, the House defines the term survivor in codified law, and then an uncodified provision limits the use of the appropriation in this bill to a survivor who was on the bridge when it collapsed. And I believe that the Senate is similar in that regard. I don't know if Ms. Pontius wants to add any nuances on that Senate definition.
Oh, no, Mr. Chairman, no, it's basically a natural person who is present on the bridge. And then the Senate has a little more detail in terms of the other persons who could bring claims, would be the parent or guardian of a minor, or a legally appointed representative, or a surviving spouse or next of kin who would be entitled to bring a wrongful death claim under statute, where the House refers to either the survivor who was on the bridge or the personal representative of the person.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hahn.
Can I ask a question at this point? Apparently there were a couple of people who were injured who went to aid the survivors and who were injured in the course of doing that, who were not, they were there minutes after the bridge collapsed rather than being on the bridge. I don't think there are a lot of those people, but I do think that there are some who are been interested in filing claims. Is there any mechanism for trying to take care of those?
Representative Khanna, I can be corrected, but I think that under the definitions in both bills, they would be not eligible.
Right.
And, of course, I think we could discuss that issue here at some greater length.
I guess it's an issue I would like. You know, I don't know if it would fall under things like the Good Samaritan parts of the law that we have. I don't expect an answer right now. I just like to put that on the table as something that I'd like dealt with.
Consider it on the table, Representative Khan. You can continue.
Mr. Chair, members, the next difference on page 2 of the comparison document is a significant administrative difference in the two bills. The House provides for a single person who would be appointed by the Executive Council to serve as a special master to determine claims under the bill. It has some administrative provisions for the special master to hire employees, enter into contracts, generally sort of following executive branch procedures. Provides that administrative costs of the special master would be limited to 1% of the total appropriation, which would be roughly slightly less than $400,000 for the special master. And then it requires reporting of administrative expenses to legislative budget chairs.
And Mr. Chairman, members, the Senate approach has a special master panel, which would be three individuals appointed by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, so it takes more of a judicial branch approach. They have to be three attorneys, at least one of whom is a retired judge, and the non-judicial members would have to have experience in legal issues involving the settlement of tort claims and the determination of damages, and then the state court administrator would be responsible for hiring employees and providing administrative support. And I think the panel would also have the authority to adopt procedures and rules and forms for administering its duties. So some of those kind of technical details are similar in both bills, but the basic structure, overall structure, is different.
Yes. It's Tim, must represent a town.
In the rule, I should have read the bill more carefully, I guess. In the rules adoption, are the rules adopted exempted from Chapter 14 in both cases? Again, just put it on the table for what's up.
For Ms.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Khan, the Senate bill doesn't refer to Chapter 14, the idea being that this is a judicial branch function, where the House bill does specifically say they're not subject to Chapter 14, I think, except with one little exception where they have publication requirements and reviews.
Continue then with your presentation.
Mr. Chair, at the bottom of the second page of the comparison is some details on the deadline for filing claims and claims procedures. The House has a September 1, 2009 deadline for filing claims, and probably the most significant instruction there that the House gives to the special master is that the special master must not consider negligence or other theories of liability in determining claims. The House then has a timeline for how the special master would act and make offer back to the survivors, and how the survivors would accept or reject that. States that acceptance or rejection is irrevocable.
Ms. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, members, probably the first big difference is the deadline, where the House is September 1, 2009, the Senate is October 1, 2008 for filing claims. And then an offer of settlement has to be made by April 1st of 2009. So the House has a longer time period. There are more deadlines built into the process in the House bill, but the Senate bill does not specifically address. And as Mr. Shepard pointed out, the Senate doesn't explicitly state that they won't consider negligence or other theories of liability, but that is the understanding or the intent of the process, is that it will be without regard to liability. And it doesn't contain the statement that the acceptance or rejection is irrevocable.
Mr. Fitton?
Mr. Chair, that block of the comparison also has some reference to offsets, and we'll be discussing those later in the comparison. Some of this was a little hard to line up exactly, given the way the bills were structured. The next big difference is one that both Representative Winkler and Senator Lapps have alluded to already, on the top of page 3 of the comparison, and that's the cap on awards. The House has no cap on awards to individuals within the limits of appropriations. It notes that the special master may propose to compensate all survivors of the catastrophe for a uniform percentage of loss or can take other steps to ensure that the available funds can be equitably distributed among all survivors.
Mr. Chairman, members, I think the biggest difference obviously is the $400,000 cap in the Senate bill. The Senate also states that it's not subject to the $1 million cap that it would otherwise apply to all claims arising out of the bridge collapse.
The language on release, Mr. Chair, is somewhat technical, and I'm not sure want to get into the details will be important later, but I'm not sure they are now. Both bills require releases. If you work through the details of the definition, I don't think the House bill requires a release of the University of Minnesota, and I think the Senate bill does if you work through all of those details. And there's a variety of other somewhat legalistic and detailed things which, if Ms. Pontius sees a substantive thing, maybe she could point those out now.
Mr. Chairman, nothing major. I think the House does have language that the survivor has to agree to withdraw any pending actions. That's not specifically addressed in the Senate bill. There is also language in the Senate bill that the execution of the release also extinguishes any other claims that might be asserted by spouse or family member of the victim, but I think that was just more technical to make it clear. I think that's how the law would operate anyway, but that was to make that explicit.
Mr. Shepard. Mr. Chair, the next block of text that's compared has to do with the effect and the finality of a settlement. I think some of these, there's just a different level of detail on different aspects. I don't think there's key differences here. The House provides that a determination of the special master is final and that the special master's determination would not be subject to judicial review. On the next page, the House language provides that an offer to make a payment is not admission of liability and that offer is that it's not admissible in subsequent actions. And that the Senate has similar language on that particular issue. The House also then requires that the special master determine a survivor's loss and make payments without reference to the tort liability limits that are in codified state law.
Mr. Chairman, I think the both bills are very similar. The Senate, in addition to specifying that the award is not subject to judicial review, the Senate also has a provision that states that it's considered for all purposes to be an offer to settle a legal claim. And that I think that was actually language suggested by the governor's office, because is that even though you preclude judicial review, that someone might try to get like a writ of mandamus or something in court. So it was just to make it clear that this really is not, there's no way to go into court to challenge the administrative process. And then the Senate just goes into more detail as far as the rights of the victim to either accept an offer or reject an offer and go to district court, or just to go straight to district court.
Mr. Chair, on the next block of text goes to the bottom of one page and the top of the next page. The House side provides that when the special master is determining loss, the special master would offset payments made from other sources, the traditional sources referred to in the statute that governs state tort law. The House bill then provides that other sources can't eliminate or reduce their payments as a result of payments made from this fund or as a result of the survivor waiving a right to pursue legal action under this act. It then has a detailed list stating that another entity who has paid a survivor does not have a right of recovery through subrogation or otherwise against the fund. Provides that the obligation of any person or entity other than the fund to make payments to the survivor is primary, and there's a list of about 14 clauses of people that I think are identical in the House and the Senate of persons and entities who are covered by this provision stating that their payments are primary. The House bill provides that following an award to a victim, an entity claiming a subrogation interest would have 60 days to notify the state of its intent to assert this, during which time the award would remain in possession of the state, and failure to provide that notice would result in waiver of the claim.
Mr. Chairman and members, a lot of the language in the two bills is very similar. There's a little difference in how they handle collateral source payments. The Senate bill just says that the collateral source offset will be made as it is under the general statute, the collateral source, you know, is where if a victim or a plaintiff in a civil case has gotten, you know, insurance payments and things similar, workers' comp, that can be deducted from the final award. The house, but it's just the ones that they've gotten up to the time of the verdict. And then they get an offset for, say, insurance premiums that they've paid for the previous 2 years. So then there's a final calculation that's made. I think the house bill is a little broader in that it refers to future payments as well, and it doesn't provide for that offset for amounts they might have paid for premiums to get the benefit of the collateral source. So it's a little bit of a difference. But and then the Senate also has language where the House, in the case where someone is asserting a subrogation claim, where the House refers to the award remaining in possession of the state, the Senate states that the Commissioner of Finance must not make the payment. And then there's also language that if there is a notice that someone is asserting subrogation rights, that the Commissioner must withhold the payment until the subrogee abandons or waives the subrogation claim.
Mr. Shepard? Mr. Chair and members, the next block of text at the bottom of one page and continuing to the next deals with reimbursement of the state and state rights of subrogation. The House bill provides that the state subrogated to potential claims against third-party tortfeasors, anyone else who might have some liability, provides that the state is entitled to be reimbursed regardless of whether the survivor is fully compensated, and provides that the state is entitled to recover from any third party, including a contractor, for payments that the state makes from this fund to the extent that the third party was responsible for causing the catastrophe.
And Mr. Chair and members, I think the most significant difference here is that the Senate bill states that the state cannot seek reimbursement or assert a subrogation interest unless the victim has been fully compensated from other sources. Again, that might, you know, be tied a little bit to the fact that if someone, say, was their damages were capped at $400,000, the state obviously wouldn't be asserting a subrogation right against them if, in fact, their loss had been a lot more than that. And that was, I think, a concern that I think Senator Mary Olson raised in the Commerce Committee, and then there was an amendment in the Finance Committee to address that issue. So it does require full compensation before the state can step in.
Representative Fuller,
how is the total damage determined under this language? Who would determine my total damage or loss if I was paid $400,000 and I claim that if my loss is $1 million? Who would determine that total damage?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, that under the Senate bill, that's the amount of the total loss that's determined by the panel. Is the way it's calculated. So the panel might find that somebody, say, had $1 million in damages, then they would make some deductions, but because there'd be a cap at $400,000, there might be a gap in there. But it is the panel's determination of the loss. That.
Mr. Chair and members, continuing on to the last full page, the next block deals with attorney fees. Both bills provide that attorney fees are not an element of damages. The House has an additional statement that provides that an attorney representing a survivor with respect to a claim filed before the special master can't charge a fee for that representation. I don't think the Senate has that provision.
Senator Lassner.
So to clarify, the House bill defines the fee arrangements then between a private attorney and the claimant into this fund?
Senator Ladd, in the sense that it says that there cannot be a fee charged, I would add that that was an amendment offered by Representative Emmer during a committee hearing, and it is included for discussion and was not originally part of the House draft.
The next block of text, Mr. Chair, deals with data practices. In the Senate, because it's in the judicial branch, they have it starts in a little bit different place. The House is an executive branch; it would be subject to the Data Practices Act. So it specifies the House bill specifies that the name of the survivor, the amount paid, and the release signed by the survivor is public data. All other data would be designated as confidential.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think the main sort of substantive difference between the two is that under the Data Practices Act, if data are confidential, the subject does not have access to the data, whereas under the Senate language, it just states that it's not accessible to the public, so I think the subject would still have access to the subject's own data.
And just a quick comment. Representative Mary Liz Holbrook was concerned about the amount of public information that would or wouldn't apply, and she raised the possibility of applying the standards developed by the Supreme Court for a typical tort claim and what information would be public or not public. And so as we're sorting out that difference, keep in mind that we may want to revisit this issue a little bit more broadly. Senator Lance.
Ms. Pontius might be able to correct me here if I'm wrong, but my belief is that the Supreme Court, because the special master panel is administered through the auspices of the court administration, that rather than applying the Data Practices Act, which does not apply to the judicial branch, they're applying the comparable restrictions within the judicial branch to the data collected through the special master panel. So then you don't get in any questions of which branch is controlling which branch. Okay. Am I correct about that, Ms. Pontius?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Lapkus, that's correct. And just one other thing, too. The Senate has language that if the victim elects not to settle and goes to court, that the state cannot use data provided by the victim in a subsequent legal proceeding. So that was a concern that the state might have an edge at that in a litigation because it had gotten all this information from the victim in the claims process.
Shepard?
Mr. Chair and members, the next difference is in the appropriation, which Senator Latz already pointed out is a key difference. First of all, the House creates a codified catastrophe survivor fund that would consist both of money appropriated by law and by any gifts or other revenues that might be deposited in that fund. Specifically for this purpose, the House appropriates $39.32 million and then provides that no more than 1% can be spent on administrative expenses.
Ms. Pontius?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, there was, I think, as Mr. Shepard pointed out, as far as the administrative expenses, the Senate just has a separate line appropriation for that amount, which would be $750,000 versus the 1% of the House bill. The current amount would be $390,000, I believe.
Senator Lapp.
So I'm not clear how this fund would operate with gifts and other revenue sources. Is the appropriation of $39.32 million, is that a hard cap on the money that's available to distribute them to the survivors, or is the cap turns out to be whatever happens to be in the fund from whatever sources of which the state would be contributing $39.32 million.
Senator, the appropriation is for $39.32, and if additional money came in through gift or any other kind of device, the total amount of the fund would increase. I don't anticipate that there will be a significant gift to change that total amount. That could happen, but it seems unlikely.
Is there any provision in the bill then that would set sort of a cutoff so that at some point if the claims exceed the total amount in the fund, there would have to be some sort of proportional or equitable reduction in claims that are, or in amounts that are paid? But you have to have a final number in order to be able to do that. And if there's still potentially more money coming in over the course of time, is there any kind of a cutoff that's anticipated in there, or is that left open at this point?
Senator, that is left open. We do have, as Mr. Shepard identified, language requiring, authorizing the special master to develop some sort of equitable percentage. And if additional money came in, I suppose that would be added on to that in order to make that percentage. But there is no time limit or otherwise to, at one point, cut off any additional money that could come into the fund. And frankly, the idea was originally that if a significant third-party tortfeasor wanted to contribute a significant amount to the fund as a part of a global settlement package, we could entertain that as a possibility as part of the waiver provisions that we're including here. So far, there's been little interest indicated to me or that I'm aware of among those potential third-party defendants to do that. Representative Silver.
However, isn't it automatically built into the other provisions with the dates that are there for a master to make that decision, an automatic date that they would have to have this done by?
Representative Silberg, there is the deadline, I think, is September 1st, 2009, to submit a claim, and there are, in the House bill, deadlines by which a proposed compensation amount would be given to the survivor, and they have, I think, 30 days to make a determination of whether they want to settle that. So ultimately, there would be a final cutoff date. But I think what Senator Lass was getting to is that if the special master is determining what percentage of loss they will pay out as a policy matter for all survivors, you at some point need to know the total amount you might have to pay and the total amount of claims that you have coming in order to do that. And so it may take a while before you can do that if the amount of money is continually increasing. Again, I think that's unlikely to happen as a matter of fact, however. Mr. Shepherd or Ms. Parnia?
Mr. Chairman, then I don't know if you've talked about the White House appropriation yet. But both bills have a $680,000 appropriation to White House. The only difference in the language, I think, is there's Senate language that specifies that the services paid for cannot be services that would have been funded by settlement payments made to victims, and it also requires White House to submit a budget to the Commissioner of Finance, so showing services that will be provided. And then once that budget is approved, then the money becomes available.
Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
I'm a little concerned by the use of the word could, that could have been funded by settlement payments, as opposed to, you know, how the timeline for determining that. But the reason we wanted to give that we both agreed to give this big grant to White House was that we figured the kind of victims that were on the bus were not really able, you know, needed some better coordinator to get them through the process. So I don't need an answer to that now. I just want to put that, how that would work, how this determination of services that could have been funded by settlement payments as opposed to services that were funded by settlement payments. Okay.
Senator Lass?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, this amendment was added in the Senate Finance Committee to respond to concern that there might end up being double recovery by any individuals on the White House bus that would also qualify for settlement payments, and settlement payments which include payments for medical care, including therapeutic, psychological, psychiatric care. So if they were going to be given this treatment or additional care through the White House appropriation and then would also receive compensation through a different vehicle for exactly the same services, then those individuals would in fact get compensated twice for the same loss the same purpose. So that was the theory behind that.
Mr. Chairman, I completely agree with the theory. I'm not sure how it would work as I read this language. That could happen. In other words, we'd like the one thing we know that will go very fast is that this $680,000 will go to White House and they'll be immediately doing the things that they need. In fact, they're doing some of this with some of the private money that they've received. What I'm concerned is that, you know, they'll be worried about spending that language because they're getting into this could have been, is that if we make this pay, if we spend this money now, is that something that could have been funded by settlement payments? And I said, so again, I agree with the concept of no double dipping. I'm not sure how it actually works with this language. So just smart guys, figure it out.
Mr. Shepherd, I think that was a handoff to you.
Mr. Chair, members, the last provision is the House has a provision that forbids the Commissioner of Administration from accepting new applications under the emergency relief process that was set up this fall. allows them to continue to process anything that has already been received.
Connie, do you have any comments on that?
No, Mr. Chairman, that's not in the Senate call.
Excellent. If there are questions or comments or any discussion that you feel is really necessary to take place now, we can do that. Otherwise, Ms. Roberts can present the fiscal side of things. Okay. Well, then why don't we start with some discussion then? Mr. Senator Lance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I neglected to mention in my opening remarks, Senator Hahn, who is on our E-12 committee, is meeting on that committee right now, but he's the fifth member of the conference committee on the Senate side. He also served on the subcommittee on claims through all of those proceedings as well. And I should note that Senator Betzold serves on the Senate Finance Committee, so he's kind of our finance representative, if you will, on the conference committee. I did have a question also to try to understand how the Senate bill would work here with regard to the equitable distribution of the fund. You have a timeline in here that specifies once a claim is made that there's a very strict schedule by which the special master must determine the award and make the offer of the award for prompt payment. Yet I'm wondering how that fits with the what I think is probably the likely proposition that there will be insufficient total funds available to compensate for everyone's claimed loss, in which case I would think the special master would have to wait until all of the claims are in, that final deadline in September of 2009, if I recall, before determining how much money is available and what proportional or other reductions need to be made in individual payments. Maybe someone can explain to me how those two provisions would work together.
Mr. Shepard? Oh, I thought you were indicating. No. Senator, the House bill tries to balance two competing challenges. One is that at times it may take up to 2 years after an accident to determine what the final or likely long-term impact on disability or medical condition would be as a result of the accident. At the same time, we are trying to provide a timeline to indicate to survivors that this will happen as quickly as possible. One solution, and it isn't specified in the bill, there is significant discretion at the special master, but one solution could be that given the amount of information that's been collected already, both as part of the legislative process and by attorneys and representatives for survivors, is that they could collect and get an approximate total figure for the amount of loss and then stage payments out over time. There's nothing in here I don't think that would prohibit them from staging those payments out over time until they had final information. But it may be that we need to adjust to some degree the approach that we're taking in order to make it possible to get the most accurate or complete or universal final percentage on payments made by the special master. It depends on where you weigh if you think that getting a fixed percentage that by which every loss will be multiplied for payment, if that's the most important thing to get the most important number, then you would have to adjust how we do this. If you want a certainty of the process to go through, then providing specific deadlines would be good. And if you want to provide the maximum amount of time to get the extent of injuries known, then you want to extend that deadline out. And so there are kind of three moving parts that we try to balance by putting it together this way.
Mr. Chairman, it just seems to me if someone wanted to make sure there were enough funds available to compensate what they would perceive to be their full loss, that they'd be well advised to get their claim in early before the funds are gone, because someone who gets their claim in toward the deadline might find that all of the funds have been distributed and there's very little left for them, even though they may have waited to find out the full extent of their long-term losses. So there'd be very little left for the special master to equitably distribute at that point, especially if the special master is under constraints to make offers within, looks like, within 120 days, and then 20 days after that, make an offer So I'm just trying to figure out administratively how this would all work.
Senator, I think you're correct in pointing out that there would be an incentive to move quickly and get your claim in quickly at the risk that you may not have given the full amount of time to know the extent of injuries. And if we wanted to, we could change the deadline and even move it up by a full year to September 1st, 2009, which would mean that approximately a year and a month after the bridge collapse, we would have all claims in, and you could determine what the total amount of payment would be before distributing any money. That would be an alternative under the House proposal. Mr. Mossman is here, and unless we have additional questions now, I think I'll turn it over to the fiscal staff to present the Senate fiscal note and the, I guess I would say, the House fiscal assumption.
Mr. Chair, we've decided to sit at this table in part because we've been working through this, dealing also with the constraints for circulation with Hamas and the supplemental budget process. And so we're going to be doing a little back and forth on the fly in terms of the presentation. And I think you've already reviewed the appropriations to the side-by-side service. The difference in the appropriations to the bill. The two bills have been discussed, the Senate having a total of $26.43 million and the House a total appropriation of $40 million, including the administrative costs and the wage health grant. And I'm going to start a little bit just talking about the process that both the House and Senate have used. And one of the first points and assumptions that I want to discuss is that as this process started through the Claims Committee and then moving into the House and Senate, that Mr. Mossman and I, and also to some extent with the Department of Finance, decided that the facts of what happened on the bridge, who was on the bridge and the impacts are not a subject of debate. And so we've been trying to the extent possible to compare data sets without, certainly without revealing any confidential data that was given to either one of us. And so we do have a common data set mm-hmm. that we've been working on, and at different times one of us has sort of been refining it and then handing it off and refining it throughout the process. We began with data from the Minneapolis Police Department and the Hennepin County Sheriff's Department, which was the original data for the that listed what they knew as far as the vehicles that were on the bridge and the individuals that were on the bridge. We supplemented some of that with media reports. The Star Tribune, in particular, has some pretty extensive coverage of the bridge victims. And then we've also been able to compare that with the claims data that's been filed to date with the Department of Administration, mostly notices of claims, but it's helped us sort of refine who's the data as far as who was on the bridge and what we think are some reasonable assumptions in terms of what the future claims might look like. And as part of that process, I should note that just recently we've adjusted the number of people on the bridge down to 183, and I think the number that we had been using was 187, and I believe that's because we were carrying 66 people for the Waite House bridge, or Waite House bus, and there actually were 62 people on the bus. We were sort of double counting some of the adults that were employed by Waite House that showed up in the Minneapolis police data individually, but then were also included in the total for Waite House.
Representative Tolbert,
do we have any kind of data on the number of people that maybe were involved for the question that Representative Kahn asked?
Ms. Roberts.
That came there and had good Samaritans and
right.
were helping.
I think we actually were discussing that earlier this morning, that there's some indication of that from the claims notices with the Department of Administration. We can tell that there are claims, notices of claims that have been filed by people that do not appear in the Minneapolis Police Department data as having been on the bridge. But I think at least from one media report, it may be clear that some of those claims, and it's a very small amount, are people that were actually on the scene. So there is some information available. We do know that there are, I think, at least two people that probably are people that were on the scene and helped the victim.
Thank you.
Just to note, there have been 163 notices filed to date with the Department of Administration, a notice of a personal injury claim. And again, it includes a very small number of people that were, as far as we can tell, not actually on the bridge. And then we also can tell that there were people that were on the bridge that have not filed a notice. And I think reviewing the data that we have, it looks like those are people that, for the most part, had minor injuries, at least as reported in the police department data. So it may be that those people may never file a claim. They may feel that their needs have been taken care of. But I think our judgment is there probably would still be about 155 to 160 right. claims that we would expect. And I don't know if you want to... Okay. Moving on, so that was the original data that we had, and then as we've continued to refine it, there has been more specific data, and I think Mr. Monson probably can speak to this in the most detail, but aggregate data that was provided by the two attorneys, or the attorneys representing the providers, the pro bono consortium and the Schwebel law firm, both provided aggregate data on economic losses to the victims. And that those economic loss figures included both past and future wage losses and uncompensated medical expenses.
Mr. Chair and members, Matt Mossman, Senate Fiscal Staff. As Ms. Roberts indicated, the information that we received from the consortium, the pro bono consortium, and then the Schwebel law firm was aggregate data. And actually, you know, the data itself, once we received it, is, I think, indicative of kind of the moving set of information, since we don't really have any specific information on the component pieces that would eventually go into what happens and what gets paid out. We don't have any specific information on an individual basis of medical costs, of wage loss information, of insurance. So just to kind of underscore that, everything that we've been working from is at a much higher aggregate and self-reported level than that. So, and in fact, some of the data that we received for about 100 individuals, most of the data was an estimate of the law firm's estimate of economic losses. And we thought that the other data that we received initially was similarly just an estimate of economic losses, but after more conversations with the law firm, what we came to understand is that it was actually information that was an assumption of the law firm's eventual court payout from their experience of what a court would probably settle on, which is different from the starting point. So I tried to do some extrapolation to get a sort of apples to apples as best you can comparison there. So when we talk about the economic losses that, and when we talk about the fiscal note that I put together, this will be particularly relevant. But so we started with a starting point. There's roughly $55 million in economic losses, and I've been hesitant all along to even use that sort of aggregate number, just because, you know, it's not based on any sort of analytical, individualized data that we have available to us. And it reflects also a large portion, but a portion of the potential claimants nonetheless, because not all claimants are represented, potential claimants are represented by these two groups that we received information from.
Mr. Mossman is going to talk in more detail about his fiscal estimate. He did do a really thorough fiscal estimate. I mean, I think he's just sort of outlined all of the limitations on it in terms of the data. And he can discuss that in more detail. But he also shared with me the underlying model that he used and sort of walked me through it, and we so I understand how the calculations in his fiscal note were derived. And just for an example, I want to, and I can give this to the committee members later, we just didn't have enough time to sort of finalize what we wanted to discuss, is using that Senate model, I just looked at what happens when the caps are applied and without the individual caps. And I think this goes back to Senator Lass's point of there are two main differences between the bills, the first being the application of the individual caps. And in fact, and Mr. Mossman can explain on this, that actually has a big impact and sort of drives the funding in terms of sort of the limits of what the funding would be. The model that he used for in sort of the middle assumption, I think, of compensating or collateral offsets comes to a total of $21.3 million for payments or estimated payments for the personal injuries and wrongful death. By simply removing the cap using that model, the total estimated losses would be $43.9 million. So that's compared to, you know, what the House has in their appropriation. I don't think it's necessarily real different. And there are certainly assumptions in there that people may disagree with, and you could have some discussion of that later. The collateral offset assumption may vary, and that would drive some differences in the non-cap model. But I think I should let him...
Mr. Chair, members, if it's your preference, I can go through the analysis that I did for the Senate.
Mr. Mossman, before you do, well, Ms. Roberts sort of still have the table there. Could you tell me how the House figure of $40 million was put into the bill before Mr. Mossman had completed his analysis? So could you explain to me how the House came up with its $40 million figure or $38 million figure for compensation?
Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chair, I can tell you some of the information that I provided to members. The $40 million figure was a determination by the members of the House, and I think I would defer to the Conference Committee members to explain how that specific number was derived.
Representative Goldberg. Mr. Chair and members, Representative Carlson and myself as Finance Chair and my Chair of Ways and Means Committee had extensive conversations with the Department of Finance and the Executive Branch on what is the number that was that they were considering for this particular bill. As you see, we put in the $40 million before the governor released his budget, which is an indication, since the governor put in $40 million, that we've had extensive conversations with the governor's office and the Department of Finance on it. I think that was done probably with some calculations within the Department of Finance as well of what would be the level of compensation. Now, there has not been probably a detailed analysis of that, and I think some of the assumptions that fiscal staff are making are just that, assumptions, and I think probably the Department of Finance is making some of those similar assumptions as well. But you also see that the governor put in the supplemental budget the same number that we have of $40 million. So now he funds it differently, and I would, as far as I've got the floor, I would hope at some point we would have some testimony on the availabilities of the constitutionality of those particular funds as the way the governor has funded it. But I think it's an indication that we had strong, lots of conversations with the Department of Finance on a number to carry forward.
Senator, I guess I would only add that I think in our conversations and conversations with Governor's staff, we had discussed a range of $30 to $60 million, and the $40 million figure was something that the Department of Finance, I think, ultimately determined was kind of a budget comfort zone, probably more than anything else. But the analysis bears out at least the rough number. And I think it's also important to know that it's the intention in the House bill to not appropriate additional money in future years. The $40 million is
the total maximum that the state will pay out. And so I think that also is part of the determination of the amount rather than anticipating future appropriations. Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, the $40 million that's contemplated in the House bill, is that just a straight-up appropriation from the general fund?
Senator Mua, Representative Solberg was alluding to this, in the House bill it is a straight appropriation from the general fund. The governor's supplemental budget has $20 million from the general fund and $20 million from the Trunk Highway Fund. Mr. Mawson?
Mr. Chair and members, just starting that kind of to frame it a little bit, the Senate bill, obviously, as I know you heard testimony in the side-by-side earlier today, makes a different policy choice that there be some caps included in the individual compensation amount. So the parameters, if you will, in terms of what any individual would receive under the Senate bill is a measure of total damages, including economic damages and non-economic losses, less any collateral offsets from insurance, workers' compensation, other things, any payments from the emergency fund that was set up last fall, and less any court fees or payments up to a maximum of $400,000. Obviously, then the overall amount that would be paid out under that proposal would be the sum of the settlement offers made to all individuals based on that, those parameters, less any individuals, obviously, who were made settlement offers and chose not to accept them. So that just kind of frames a little bit how the math would work. On the fiscal note, then, I guess I'm going to turn probably just to flip to the back side a little bit, which gives the detail, if you care to follow along there. But essentially what I did to recap is we had a set of information which, as Ms. Roberts testified earlier, started with police and sheriff's department data, which really had no information at all on economic losses. So we made contact with a couple of the law firms who represented the most of the potential claimants to try and get some sense of that. And the information they provided, I think, was particularly helpful in two regards. Obviously, getting some information on what economic losses might look like, but also the distribution of potential losses across the kind of pool of potential claimants in terms of which claimants, what proportion of claimants would tend to be smaller claims, or which proportion would tend to be catastrophic claims and other death claims. Obviously, we knew what that number was. If you look at table one, then on the back of page four of the fiscal note, this just is a summary essentially of looking at just the aggregate information that was provided by those law firms for, and that should say 110 cases, I believe, is what that totals to in column A. Those with column B, then, is the losses that were indicated. The economic loss is a sum of the economic losses indicated by the law firm plus an estimate of non-economic losses. And so this is one of the first assumptions here, and I can come back to it also, but the assumption is just that non-economic losses is 100% of or equals the same amount as economic losses. Then column C is an assumption of collateral offsets, the second significant assumption here, and the assumption was made of a 75% assumption across the board in collateral offsets. So that through some means, whether it be health insurance, life insurance, workers' compensation, et cetera, that 75% of the total losses would be somehow compensated through collateral sources. When you look at that, then you would get an average net claim without a cap, and then column E is just to show what the implications of the cap would be, and certainly for the level of aggregate losses that seem to be being reported for
potential death pains and persons with catastrophic injuries, it suggested that both of those two type of potential claimants would reach the cap. Table 2 then was an effort, if you drop down to the middle of the page, to just say, well, if we take that model and extrapolate it to the full potential pool, which at that time, before we, as Mr. Roberts indicated, got some additional information from Weight Health and adjusted it, was 187. So Table 2 then just extrapolates that information and it ramps it up to a potential pool with 187 using the distribution of injured persons and death claims up to the full pool of 187. So you can see, for example, catastrophic injuries seem to be about 7% of those reported by the law firms, so 7% of the individuals in the overall potential claimant pool were assumed to have catastrophic injuries. When you do this, you arrive at, and again, apply the caps, you arrive at estimated settlement offers of about $21.3 million. And, you know, again, having put this in place, the one thing I would emphasize is, you know, the comments of Ms. Roberts earlier, it illustrates the policy choice of the caps, and that that is where moving, for example, from 100% to, say, 50% on the collateral offset or on the non-economic loss assumption, or moving from 75% to 65% on the assumption of collateral offsets makes a marginal difference relative to the other policy choices that that is in the Senate position. So that is the other component piece then that I looked at is I looked at property damage claims separately just to get a sense of that information. One thing here is the language of the bill, and I think that this language, I forget what applied to both bills, but for persons, not all of the vehicles, for example, were owned by people who were on the bridge. So this makes some sort of and we're able to tell that a little bit because the information, we have both registration information, who they were registered to, and now information about people who were actually on the bridge. And so it looks like, for example, of the 75 vehicles or so that were on the bridge, whether they be construction vehicles or personal automobiles, that about 48 would have been owned by people who were on the bridge. And so auto loss is really the only thing that I included here and assumed, made an assumption of collateral offset on that as well. This is obviously a small amount relative to the personal injury, and so I added in about $240,000 in the mid-range for property damage claims. Jumping back then to the front of the fiscal note, if you will, for, you know, to give some sense of range again of the Senate proposal, what I did is I basically employed the model that I described to you, and then subsequent to that adjusted the assumption of the collateral offset, which seemed to be in my conversation with law firms, certainly one that was, and I must admit there was no rigorous analysis on my part. There was no rigorous analysis on my part in terms of looking at the industry and seeing what tends to be a typical amount of collateral offset. But if you were to move that number around, you get a sense of the range around the assumption of 75% collateral offset.
Committee members, we do have about 20 minutes more left in the scheduled time. We have the room longer, but I tend to like to try to keep to the schedule as possible. It's important, I think, both to hear the basic assumptions and underpinnings and have questions about how the bills are put together, but certainly not all House members on this conference committee have had an opportunity to hear from the people who were impacted by the grid collapse. But I also want to make sure we have time for them within the time constraints as well. So I think they're open for questions, but we do want to keep this moving as well. Representative Solberg.
Do you have any anticipation on what the next meeting will be as well?
Representative Solberg, I defer to Senator Lass, but it's my understanding that we have it scheduled, that he's scheduled it for 8:30 Friday morning.
Okay. And the reason I ask that is because I do have a conference now at 10 o'clock that I must be at. So.
Okay. Well, then I didn't see any eager questions. I don't know if Senator Lass does.
Yeah, thank you. I did, actually, from Mr. Mawson. I'm trying to understand, or Ms. Roberts, the numbers you put together here, assuming the 75% collateral source offset, had average net claims in there, and then you extrapolated that out from 100 claimants to 187. So when you determined that the $400,000 cap limits settlement amounts by an estimated $22.6 million, was that after calculating the collateral source offsets for both the death categories and the catastrophic injury categories, and then extrapolated out for 187 claimants?
Ms. Mawson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lass, yes, and it was applied... It was applied at the category level, though, so the offset would have been applied at the category of those, the assumption of the number of catastrophic injuries at the category of the 13 death claims.
So, Mr. Mossman, you basically, you assumed here then that a death claim after offset would be on average $1 million?
Correct, Mr. Chair. I think that if you, again, just kind of reiterating, I would have to go back and I could put in a different number, but I believe that even if you had a collateral offset, for example, of 50%, I mean, that, I think that range could be fairly significant, and the cap would still be the issue on the death claim.
So if the let's say the death claims and the catastrophic injury claims extrapolated out, totaling 25, were each to get payments of $1 million. That'd be $25 million right there, right? If we didn't apply the cap, and actually you got catastrophic average claim of $1.6 million. So, but if we just round it off to $1 million for each of the two most severe categories, that would be $25 million alone right there, wouldn't it?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Okay.
And then everyone else then would have to divide whatever other funds are left, depending on whatever the total appropriation is, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lass, that's correct.
But the analysis that you went through would not be binding on any special master or special master panel in making determinations about what the total loss is or what should be equitably compensated, right?
Mr. Mawson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lass, that's correct. Ultimately, you know, you have the appropriations structure that the bill would take, whatever form that takes, that would be the issue of relevance there, I think, and that, you know, would be if it's a capped appropriation amount and it's evenly distributed, or if it's a capped appropriation amount and it's not evenly distributed amongst the claimants, you would have that issue of distribution to occur within that appropriations cap. And that's what would become the driving factor when you, rather than this sort of analysis.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Mossman, if let's say the collateral source offset number is assumption, it should be 50% instead of 75%, for example, then the actual out-of-pocket losses might be quite a bit higher for individuals. And so at some point you get to let's assume it's a percentage reduction so that everyone ends up with the same proportion, a percentage of their losses in payments from the fund. If that has to be 50% to fit within the fund, then people who might otherwise get $200,000 in, say, the severe injury category that you identified, or $258,000, they would get paid $130,000 instead, right? So it would be about $130,000 difference to those individuals if there were just an across-the-board percentage applied. If all you had was a full fund without any other guidelines within the use, within that fund.
Mr. Mawson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lass, if you had an across-the-board percentage, the proportional impact on all of the potential claimants would be the same. Certainly, the individuals who have the greater economic losses would get far larger payouts, and that most of the appropriation would end up going for that type of, for those claimants rather than for someone who has a claim of $150,000 or $200,000.
So, I mean, if I'm using, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Mawson, so if I'm using your table too, it says severe injury category is 28 individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Using the figure you came up with in table one is about $250,000 average net claim within that category. If they were only to receive 50% payout because the fund was limited and that was a number that was set across the board, 50% for everyone, that would reduce the payment for those 28 individuals by about $130,000. Right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. And then for the others in your category, the PTSD and soft tissue category, you assume the average claim was about $30,000. For those 132 people, they would end up with $15,000 instead of $30,000 under your scenario, right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And actually, perhaps a little bit more than that. I'm not sure. You know, just taking the model I have put together here, I think that the 50% would probably be a little bit less than 50% at the $40 million level, for example.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions? The fiscal staff, I think, will be with us, I'm guessing, at the next meeting as well, and presuming along through the process so we can address specific questions. But I think we'd like to move on now to testimony from survivors, and we're going to start with Brad Coulter. We have Paula on here, but I don't see her in the audience, so I think Brad will have to represent the family. We have, Mr. Coulter, we have about 15 minutes left on our schedule, so if you could try to limit your presentation to 4 minutes or so, that would give us a time for a follow-up question. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Brad Coulter. I'm a victim of the Missouri class. I'd first like to start out by thanking the committee, in particular Senator Latt, Representative Winkler, for all the work you've done. We're very grateful for the speed that this is going through and the effort that you're putting in here. Without the effort, the current legislation would be devastating for some of the families. On August 1st, my wife Paula and I and my two daughters were on the bridge on the north end when it collapsed. Our van fell 65 feet, landed on the roof. The windows blew out. The airbags went off. My dogs were able to climb out the side. I was able to get out my passenger window. I looked behind, and my wife was still in her seatbelt suspended. She was hurt pretty bad. I gathered my daughters, and we went up a sandhill to get away from the lanes of highway that were suspended over my van, just to get to safety. We were taken to a triage. About 10 minutes later, some rescue folks brought my wife on plywood to the triage area, and they realized she was pretty bad. They got her to HDMC as fast as they could. She went directly into surgery. She had traumatic brain injury, and she shattered her L1 vertebrae in her back. So she was in surgery. During surgery, her heart stopped. They had to resuscitate her to get her going again. My daughters were also taken to HCMC. They spent 4 days in the hospital there. I was taken to North Memorial, and I spent 5 days there. We all had back injuries and wore back braces for 3 months. Paula was actually in ICU for a month. She ended up having 3 different surgeries. One to actually take a piece of her skull out for brain pressure, and then the second surgery is to put it back in, and then the third one is to actually fix her back. After a month in ICU, she was transferred to NAP rehab, where she had to do physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, basically to learn how to walk and talk and reason for herself. She spent a month there, and then she transferred to Courage Center in Golden Valley, where she spent 2.5 months doing the same thing with rehab. She was able to come home to us on December 14th, and we're happy to have her there. The point I'm making in all this is my whole family was involved in the accident. Paul has had to relearn how to walk and talk again. She faces a lifetime of constant pain and medical problems. She will exceed $1 million in medical bills just for herself. Even after 8 months, I still have $500,000 still outstanding. She's scheduled to have at least 2 more surgeries this year. I have good insurance, but it doesn't cover everything. Her biggest dilemma right now is it limits her on the number of therapies she can do. She can only do 90 a year, so she has to kind of strategically attend those. We're hoping she can get back to work. If not, that could mean close to $2 million in lost revenue. My daughters are both on scholarship to play soccer. But they may never see the field to realize those scholarships because of their injuries also. I'm injured and have constant pain myself and just trying to hold my family together. Today I sit here as an advocate for those of the injured, and I ask you to consider removing the cap or provide exemptions for those who have lost loved ones or were seriously injured in this tragedy.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Colt. Questions from the committee? Spencer last.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Coulter, thank you again for appearing before these proceedings. As you can gather, we're trying to get our arms around the potential financial expense involved in compensating survivors. And it would be most helpful to us, and you mentioned that you've got good insurance, yet you've got $500,000 in outstanding bills. I'm not sure what's anticipated to be covered by insurance or what isn't, or by other sources. It would be helpful, I don't want to take up all the committee's time right now asking some of these specific financial questions, but there are a very limited number of individuals that were catastrophically injured. It would be most helpful, I think, if we could try to nail down the specific financial situations of individual claimants so we can figure out what kind of amounts might need to be appropriated to figure out what our exposure and what our obligations might turn out to be. Would you be willing to share with the committee some more details about your individual situation, your level of insurance coverage, what you're expecting will not be covered by insurance in terms of medical expenses and lost wages? People have no-fault insurance. Some people are covered by work comp. Others have good insurance policies, but maybe not enough, or they expect to exceed their lifetime benefit at some point. Would you be willing to share some of that specific information so that we can try to make those determinations?
Mr. Colt,
today?
Well, not necessarily right now, but as we kind of move through these proceedings.
Oh, definitely.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Can I ask one other question, if I might? If you had to, you know, there are a lot of different categories of reimbursement that are used in tort law. You know, we talked a little bit about non-economic loss damages, economic loss damages. So, you know, pain and suffering, there's lost, past lost wages, future lost wages, medical expenses, those kind of things. If you were going to prioritize for your own purposes, those categories, which would you say is the most important category that you would wish to have reimbursed for?
I'd have to start out with the medical. Medical and then wage loss. Those are going to be the first two that hit us hard.
Thanks, Mr. Coulter. Other questions? Okay, thank you. And next on the agenda is Linda Paul. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Again, unfortunately mindful of time constraints.
Yes. My name is Linda Paul. This is my husband, Gene Johnson. I was on the north end of the bridge heading to downtown when it collapsed. You have copies of my testimony along with a picture showing the section of the bridge that I was on. I haven't fully recovered from my eye injury, and from time to time when I'm reading, my eyesight becomes unstable and my double vision returns. This photo is a close-up of my first field stop-at-home van. It ended up right next to the fallen structure that held up the green freeway sign. This same structure fell on Patrick Holmes' car and killed him. Just a short distance away, Tom Hughes' truck landed on top of another vehicle, crushing it. Michael Weiss survived, but was in the hospital for 5 weeks. Jesse Shelton, far enough away so that she was not hit by the sign. However, because of her injuries, they had to cancel a show at the Children's Theater in which she had a starring role. Right behind my van is a collapsed section that looks like a giant inverted V. Artemio Trinidad Mania died after plunging almost 60 feet. Nearby, emergency ropers pulled Tina Hickman from the windshield of her van. She was 8 months pregnant and gave birth to a son hours later after having an emergency C-section. Kars Olsen suffered 2 cracked vertebrae, a broken clavicle, broken bones, and torn ligaments in his shoulder. He had short-term memory loss and couldn't remember anything until the Saturday after the collapse. Mercedes Gordon had massive fractures in her legs and broken vertebrae. Red Coulter has already told the story of his family. This photograph shows me on a stretcher after being on my way to the hospital. The blood streaming from my face was caused by a chunk of concrete that smashed through the window of my van, crushing my cheekbone and eye socket. 5 vertebrae in my back were fractured and ribs were broken when the van came to its sudden stop. I've also suffered traumatic brain injury. Considering the trauma and suffering that took place around me, I feel I was very fortunate. Also, because I was working at the time of the collapse, workers' comp has covered many of my bills. Many victims were not so fortunate. Some have nearly depleted their personal savings and insurance benefits. Others have been sustained only through the generosity of family, friends, and strangers. At group meetings, I've listened to the stories of those who were on the bridge and some who were not. One was a construction worker who was not on the bridge at the moment of collapse, but was injured while pulling victims out of their cars. He was concerned that in trying to help people, he may have caused them more injury, and this has been tormenting him. During the winter, he ended up homeless and living out of his car. Another person going off southbound on the bridge, when the bridge fell, he drove down the exit ramp, jumped out of his truck, ran to the river, jumped in the water, and helped Garrett Ebling, who was severely injured and could have drowned. As this citizen first responder told his story, it was clear that he was still very traumatized by what he had experienced. It is the future that causes the greatest concern for me right now. In the survivors groups, we've been told to try to accept something called the new normal. Many of us will not know what our new normal is for some time. My doctors have told me that they cannot give me a long-term prognosis of what to expect until August of this year. Before my current job, I was a professional tailor, and I did interior design work. I love to sew, but since the foot collapse, it has proven difficult and often painful. I've tried to adapt by continuing to wear my body brace for support, but I can only do that for short periods of time. In addition to the uncertainty that everyone experiences, BRIG victims and their families have to deal with an added layer of uncertainty forced upon them that evening. I was told just last week that because of my physical limitations, I cannot return to my job as a designer at Hirschfield. I love doing that job, and if the housing market wasn't in so much trouble right now, I'm sure that the company would find something else for me within the company. But now, at 56 years old, I must begin a search for a new job. If my eyesight and back do not return to normal, I don't know what kind of work I'll be able to do. Up to this point, I had not stopped counseling. But last week, I decided that the time had come. The psychologist who heard my story told me that I showed all the signs of PTSD. Originally, I was going to leave political comments out of my testimony, but I'm compelled to explain my point of view. The majority of BRIG survivors and victims' families strongly support Representative Winkler's House bill. That bill provides for the needs of those who are most affected by the catastrophe. In the best of all possible worlds, it is the type of response you would expect from the state of Minnesota. However, the world we live in is fraught with politics and economic downturn. As much as the House bill is my first choice, I believe Senator Lax's bill is the more appropriate response in the world in which we currently exist. This put me at odds with other BRIG survivors. Why, they asked, would you support a bill that places a $400,000 cap on individual compensation? It comes down to two issues. One is the rule of law, and the second is the likelihood that entities other than the state of Minnesota are also liable for what happened. For many years, our society has tended towards finding ways to ignore laws that inconvenience us. The House bill ignores the $400,000 cap and makes no attempt to remove that restriction from the law because legislators know that doing so will be a long and possibly futile effort. It's more convenient to disregard the law today and hope that it will not set a precedent tomorrow. Senator Lax's bill works within the law with the logical exception of removing the $1 million per incident cap. The fact that 53 senators rejected an amendment to remove the individual cap shows that the Senate is unlikely to approve a conference committee bill that tries to do likewise. Last week, Governor Pawlenty said that he favors keeping the $400,000 cap in place, but feels there should be additional help for the families of those killed and severely injured, for which I totally agree. If he truly means this, he owes it to the victims of the catastrophe to present his ideas now, so that this committee can complete its work and get a final bill for him to sign as soon as possible. Finally, I would like to thank both Representative Winkler and Senator Lass. BRIG survivors and BRIG victims' families are very fortunate to have such able legislators on their side. And thank you.
Thank you, questions? Senator Lass.
Thank you. Ms. Paul, I'll ask you the same question I asked Mr. Coulter. It sounds like you are covered by workers' compensation for your medical bills. Is that right?
Yes, correct.
So you're not expecting to have any uncompensated medical expenses down the road. Is that correct?
I don't know what goes forward into the future. I know that at this point my medical expenses are covered. Okay. I don't have concerns for that at this point.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Paul, would you likewise be willing to share your more specific financial situation with the committee at this point in the process so that we can try to get our arms around exactly what the need is for us to entertain?
No problem. I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
Okay.
And then finally, we will hear from Jennifer Holmes. Members, we are past our scheduled end time, but this I don't think will take very long. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Jennifer Holmes, and my husband Patrick died on the bridge that day. I want to thank you for listening to me today and taking the extra time. I brought this picture to show you of my family that was taken 2 weeks before the bridge went down. We were on a camping trip, and probably the last family picture that was taken. So I just kind of wanted to see you to see that, you know, I have 2 little kids that are also severely injured by this. This whole experience has been very difficult for me. The emotional aspects are hard enough to deal with. losing my best friend of 21 years is unbelievably hard. He was my partner in everything. And it breaks my heart every day when my kids talk about the fun things that they do and, you know, remember, but then realize they're not going to do that anymore with their dad because he's gone. It's also extremely hard because I have an extremely smart 7-year-old boy who continues to ask me questions about why the bridge fell down. Last week for school, he was reading a story about hurricanes, and there was a picture of a bridge that was down, and he wanted to know, well, this bridge went down because of a hurricane, but why did Dad's bridge go down? And it's really hard because I have no answers for him at this point. Raising our children to be respectful, responsible people was the most important thing to him and to us. I'm trying to do it alone, but it's very difficult. I'm so tired all the time, but there's nothing I can stop doing. I have to keep going, and I have to get everything done by myself. The hard cap that's been proposed would hurt me terribly. I lost Pat's salary, which would be well over $1 million, by adding up the years that he would have worked and been contributing to the family. I also had to pick up family insurance. He covered it through his work. He had better insurance. Mine, it's $800 a month, additional a month that I'm paying, so adding that up would be over $125,000 by the time my daughter would graduate high school. So that's the biggest chunk of money. He often took care of the kids when they were sick. I have very little time off as a teacher, and taking all the time off that I need to take care of them or myself when I'm sick, I'm afraid at some point I'm going to have to start taking time off without pay because I don't. It was always nice that he was able to take the time because he had more flex time. But, and then I also am paying a lot more in babysitting costs because I need to get babysitters now to cover things when I can't be there, and that's expensive as well. Please don't place this hard cap on my recovery and the recovery of those most injured. I know you just heard from Linda Paul and her her testimony, and it's great that her insurance has covered her bills. Many people do not have that, and it's going to seriously hurt a lot of people. If you do need to place a cap, please do as Governor Pawlenty suggested and make an exception to those most seriously harmed. Both the seriously harmed and those of us who lost a family member need additional support. I'm grateful that Governor Pawlenty recognizes that a hard cap would hurt those of us most severely injured. I cannot protect my kids if I don't have the money and resources to take care of them. I also want to thank Senator Betzold, who is my senator, for the time that he has spent listening to me and for supporting the no-cap amendment in the Senate. He lost 3 constituents in the bridge collapse, and both Betsy Sather, who lost her husband, and I have talked to him numerous times and have told him how difficult this has been. So I'm proud of you to stand up and speak for us as well. And like I said, I know there's differing viewpoints out there. I've heard the views from "we shouldn't have helped" to "the $40 million is not enough." I do believe the viewpoint that I have heard from most, and the one I personally believe, is that you need to look at each individual case and decide what would be most appropriate to help us. Those hurt the most should not be hurt further by this. And it's true that no amount of money will ever replace what my children and I have lost. You can't replace that. But if I'm helped appropriately, I'll have the peace of mind knowing that I can take care of my family. So I just want to say that it could have been anyone out there on that bridge. I've heard lots of stories. I know one of the senators was talking about how he had just crossed the bridge, and I just want you to think, what would you want the state to do if it was you that died, and how would you want them to help your family?
Thank you.
Questions?
Thank you, Ms. Holmes. Again, nice to have you here at the proceedings, as unfortunate as the circumstances are. As you gather, I'm trying to figure out the financial situation of individuals involved, because that's what the bill is kind of built around.
Can you tell me, if you wouldn't mind sharing, did your husband have life insurance?
Yes, we did have some, and it covered, you know, some of the cost, but it doesn't anywhere near cover everything that I'll be facing to raise my children.
Would you mind sharing with us how much life insurance you have? If you remember right now, fine. If you don't, if you wouldn't mind sharing it, definitely.
Between a personal one that we had and a his work one, I think it was around $300,000, I think.
Ms. Holmes, do your children qualify for any Social Security benefits through your husband?
Yes, they are receiving some.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Anything further? Okay, thank you, Ms. Holmes. Yes, Senator Ladd, I'll just offer kind of one thought and then you can close. I think if nothing else, our first session today clarifies the point that there can be no perfect response from the Minnesota legislature to this tragedy, and that the best that we can do is to try to fashion the best response we can. And I think an important question for us is how far down the path of determining financial loss and compensation amount and offsets does the legislature want to go versus designating or delegating some of that authority or discretion to the special master to take further testimony and information. I think both House and Senate agree that the kind of detailed analysis that we need to make individual compensation awards takes some time and is best done by an expert rather than by a legislative committee. However, the information that Senator Lass is seeking from the survivors is helpful in determining what the best appropriation amount and what the best type of award that we could generate would be. And I certainly feel confident that we all have the same interest in mind, which is to find the best possible remedy for the state and for these survivors. Senator Lass.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to make two notes. One is if other survivors who are here in the audience or who are watching this on paper whenever they see it would also be willing to share their specific financial information with the committee. Ultimately, once the claim is made, these details will need to be included in the claims form so that determinations can be made about collateral source offsets and damage evaluations and the whole bit. But to the extent that you might already know, whether you have medical insurance that's covered everything up until now, if you expect to exceed the cap, your lifetime benefits cap, when you think that might happen, if you have at least a major surgery, for example, that's coming up that might not have already been done, that might push you over the cap or not, otherwise be covered by medical insurance if you're covered by workers' compensation instead of a more traditional medical insurance policy, and if your plan is an ERISA plan versus a state-regulated plan, all of those would be very helpful information, I think, for us to be able to get our arms around the dollar figures that we're dealing with here. So I would certainly appreciate that, and certainly you can contact my staff or we can be in touch. I know there are many of them are represented by lawyers who would be able to have that information, probably have a lot of it already. The second note I wanted to make was that the reading through the governor's letter that came out yesterday, the governor does say in his letter that he supports the Senate bill, and he goes through in a fair amount of detail the specific key provisions of the Senate bill and his logic for supporting the Senate bill. He does state that he supports the $400,000 individual cap and does not make any reference to exceptions to that cap. I would assume primarily because in his language, settling claims without regard to the individual tort cap creates a fundamental inequity between the treatment of those seriously injured or killed in this situation from the compensation available to persons similarly injured in other situations. That's the equity argument that we've all been kind of sorting out and trying to struggle with and balance as we try to respond expeditiously and appropriately to this event and compare it to how the state has or may respond to injuries caused by the state in other events. I think it's far more to come on these and other issues, I'm sure, as we go through these proceedings. Thank you.
There are no further comments or questions. We will adjourn the meeting.